the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. And I'm grateful to Joan Fauber, Andrew Krieger, Jason Spitzer, and Andrew Rush. They volunteered to support this program by taking out a voluntary subscription. If you're financially able and you'd like to, I'd be much obliged. Go to peterbcollins.com, and on the right-hand side, our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. And coming up at the end of this podcast, our official film reviewer, Gary Chu, gives you his review of the new film about the young John Lennon called Nowhere Boy. And this is the first of two conversations with Dr. Phil Butler. I met Phil Butler in 2005 in Monterey, when we started the progressive talk station, KRXA. And I met him at a screening of a film about depleted uranium. And it was my first encounter with a man whose story I've gotten more familiar with, because he's published a memoir called Three Lives of a Warrior. And Phil Butler has appeared on my syndicated radio program on many occasions. And he is a veteran who is outspoken in his desire for peace. And I think he is better situated than perhaps anyone else I've ever met to talk about the issues of detention and torture that came front and center in Bush's so-called war on terror. Phil Butler, welcome back to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you, Peter B. It's good to be back on your show again.
Give our listeners who may not have heard you before just a quick overview of why you titled your book Three Lives of a Warrior.
Well, it's an idea that finally came to the front of my brain a couple of years ago, because for many years before that, I had told people I always felt like I've lived three lives. And the reason is the three sections of my life have been so totally different. The first one, of course, was from the time I was born up until the day I went down over North Vietnam. That was all of my early schooling and Naval Academy and military training and flight training and Navy flying and all of that good stuff.
Well, and you also had battles on the family front that we'll talk about.
Well, yeah, I didn't have exactly the easiest growing up, but probably not the toughest one. But then, as soon as I got into the hands of the North Vietnamese, my life drastically changed. It wasn't anything the same at all from what I'd experienced before. So that was my second life, and that lasted for exactly 2,855 days and nights, very close to 8 years,
mm-hmm.
Which time I was finally released from captivity and the first airplane going out. On February the 12th of 1973, that began my third life, which again was totally different from either of the other two. So having lived three lives, I thought about, you know, what got me through all this stuff and what continues to push me forward. And I think that I have inside me a warrior spirit. A warrior spirit is not something that's just used by people in war, but it comes into play in many different facets of life, if you happen to be a person who has that.
Yeah. Well, I know you from the third phase of your life, and it's a stark contrast. The voice in the book, who was a flyer, who was a POW, and who was in a combat situation behind bars at the Hanoi Hilton and other locations in North Vietnam. And we'll talk about that as we dive into your story. But it starts in Tulsa, and you were a paper boy for the Tulsa World.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's my early business opportunity was being a paper boy from 8th grade through high school for the Tulsa World and Tulsa Tribune. Back in those days, we had both morning and evening newspapers that everybody read. There was no computers or websites or anything like that, so everybody got their information, their news from newspapers. Which is interesting. I think people might have been a little more literate back then. But I was a paper boy during those days, and also worked jobs for my father, who was in the construction business, and also hung out at a little dirt strip airport southeast of Tulsa at the time named Brown Airport, where I fell in love with flying and worked weekends and sometimes evenings as the airport flunky, as I was called, gas boy, and any other odd job that was around, from cleaning toilets to clearing out the runway or whatever was needed out there. Mm-hmm. And I did that. Basically, I worked there, not for money, but for free time and the light airplanes, where I learned how to fly and eventually attained a commercial license.
And
graduated from high school.
Yeah, your dad was a pilot, and would you say that the aviation bug is perhaps one of his greatest gifts to you?
Well, I think so. I think my aviation bug goes all the way back to World War II. A really funny thing, I have framed in my office a picture that I drew in kindergarten, and it was of an airplane, of all things, so I can see that. Even way back when I was 5 years old, I was smitten with the notion of flying airplanes. And of course, this was during World War II, and everything for everybody was all about the war and what was going on with the war and combat and everybody supporting the war at that time.
And in growing up, you reveal in the book that your father was a binge drinker and that you, at a young age, in some ways became a parent to him, to take him through those difficult periods. You describe your mother, who had a very strong and difficult personality, and your strong affinity for your sister Linda, who you seem to try to protect through the turbulent times in your household.
Yeah, I think things started falling apart in my family probably when I was 10 or 11 years old, about the time my sister was born, 10 and a half years younger than I am. And at that time, my mother's personality seemed to change to one of abuse and paranoia, and I'm sure she's certain she must have been mentally ill, but she also got hooked on prescription drugs that were given out by doctors in the day. So that was a terrible situation with her, and then at the same time, and I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, with mother and father issues, because I was too young to really see how it got started, but it evolved that my father couldn't deal with alcohol. He became a binge drinker, so when they separated, and I was about 12 years or 13 years old or so, I opted to go with my father, so that I could actually, in my mind, I could help take care of him. And all the way through through high school, certainly, and in those days, it seemed that my father and I would trade roles. When he was sober, he would be the father, and when he wasn't, I would be the father and help trying to take care of him. But one thing that I learned later on in life is that with an addicted person in drugs or alcohol or whatever, you can't cure them. They have to cure themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he actually never did. He finally drank himself to death in a binge which he put himself into a coma and died. His heart stopped, died when he was 44 years old, and I was only 20 years old and a junior at the Naval Academy. So at that time, my sister was just 10, and so I did everything I could from that point to try and support her and really kind of be a sibling as well as a father image to her.
And you went to Will Rogers High School in Tulsa. When you were a high school student, did you have to keep secret the family struggles that you had and the kind of shame of the episodes with both your dad and your mom?
Absolutely. Back in the 40s and 50s, I think people weren't as enlightened about all of those kinds of issues, and kids were very embarrassed about families like that. The dominant family thing was the intact mother, father, and children and in the family, and that was really the predominant, family life of the day. So if you had something different, it was very demeaning and very embarrassing. So I really didn't feel that I was able to talk to anybody about it at the time. You just had to kind of bear up under it and do the best you could as a kid.
And Phil, you know, every time I've talked to you and as I've read your book, I detect a man who has no bitterness. And did you actually gain strength and find your inner strength through these struggles that you had through your teenage years?
Yes, I think I did, looking back on it. I don't think I knew that was happening at the time. I think I just did what I had to do and didn't really think of it as gaining internal strength until much later on when I became a prisoner of war. I think when I became a prisoner of war, I found out that I had an inner well of strength and courage that I never realized I had before. I was in high school. I was just another kid in high school. I didn't play sports particularly, though I enjoyed baseball and football and sports, but I didn't play sports because I opted to work, paper routes and what have you, so I could have money and also to be independent because my family situation was a mess and I was pretty much on my own. So in a high school class of 800 kids at Will Rogers High School, back in the day, I was just another kid in the hallway and nobody special. Oddly enough, though, now because of my involuntary incarceration as a POW, I'm now the famous guy from Will Rogers High School from my class, which always strikes me as just a bit bizarre at this point in my life.
What did the yearbook say about you in your senior year? Anything?
You know, probably not much. I don't appear any place except there's a photograph of me with my name underneath it with all the rest of my classmates. But,
yeah,
you know, the usual stuff that kids write to each other, friends and so forth. Know, have a good life, go break your neck, or whatever kids write in yearbooks. But certainly there's nothing special in my yearbook in 1956, graduates from Will Rogers High School.
And, Phil, you joined ROTC.
Well, yes. In high school, I realized that I didn't really have any money. My father's life was going downhill rapidly. So I took a physical and mental examination for Naval ROTC and managed to get what they call a regular appointment to NROTC and opted to go to Oklahoma University, which was only about 100 miles away from Tulsa and separated by a turnpike, so that my thinking was if I went to college there, I could help take care of my dad, you know, and weekends or whatever, I could come home and back and forth and so forth. But I had the NROTC scholarship at Oklahoma University, and I quickly discovered there that it was too difficult, and it just wasn't working for me to try and take care of my father. I had to give up on that idea and make a life for myself. But I only went there for 1 year.
Right. And tell us about Lieutenant Mayo and the advice he gave you that really changed your life.
Oh, what a funny incident. Here I was in a class of NROTC freshmen studying naval history, and I can just picture this guy's face in my mind as clear as my own when I look in the mirror. He made such an impression on me. His name was Lieutenant Mayo, and I've tried to look him up since unsuccessfully and find him any place. But one day at the end of class, we were all walking out, and for some reason, I have no idea why, I was no really great student. I was probably a B student in his class. But he called to me just as I was walking out the door, and he said, "Mr. Butler, would you come here, please?" And I thought, oh, my goodness, what have I done now? But anyway, I came over, and he said, he questioned me. He said, "How are you doing here at Oklahoma University?" And I said, "Well, okay, I guess, sir, maybe, you know, not as well as I could do." And he said, "Why is that?" And I said, "Well, I guess the reason is I don't really like it here very much." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, it just seems like everybody's interested in how they look and what they're wearing and the social stuff and everything." And I said, "I just don't feel like I'm really fitting in." He said, "Have you ever thought about going to the Naval Academy?" And so I said, "Well, I don't know, sir. I don't know where it is." He explained it to me. He said, "If you go there, if you really want to be a naval officer," he said, "that's the place to go." And he said, "I know you like this course." And I said, "Yes, naval science is definitely my favorite course." And he said, "Well, if you'll go to NAS, Naval Air Station, Dallas, Texas, in a few weeks, they're having a week-long dear battery of tests for people who would like to go to the Naval Academy." And he said, "Every year, a few people are picked around the country to go to the Naval Academy without a senator or congressman appointing them." So I took him up on it, and I went down and spent the week at NAS Dallas. And I remember, recall that the last thing that happened was I had an interview with a naval officer, and this guy was a Navy commander. And I looked on his chest, and he had a pair of Navy wings on, so he was a naval aviator. And he looked at my record, and he said, "I see that you have a commercial flying license." And I said, "Yes, sir, I do." He said, "Wow." He said, "And you got it on your 18th birthday." And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well, you've done well on the tests here, Mr. Butler." He said, "Would you really like to go to the Naval Academy?" And I said, "Well, yes, sir, I certainly would." And so with that, I left and finished that year in school, went home, and one evening after I'd been home in June there a few days, the phone rang, and my dad answered it, and he handed me the phone, and he said, "Son, this is from Annapolis, Maryland, and you've been appointed to the Naval Academy."
Wow.
So it turned out I had gotten one of 200 presidential appointments, and I think a lot of it had to do with this naval aviator who was impressed with me because I had a commercial license.
And had you even been to Annapolis? Have any idea what it was like there?
I had never been there. I was an Oklahoma boy,
yeah,
who had really never seen the ocean. And in the first of July, we drove out there with my father and my sister. And my first really view of the ocean was there at the Severn River at the Naval Academy. And I remember standing with about 1,500 other young inductees and holding our hand up and being sworn in to the United States Naval Academy as a midshipman, while my father and sister were in the crowd looking on.
Mm. Must have been a great moment.
I'm sure it was a great moment for my dad as much as anything else. I know my sister remembers it, but I think it was probably one of the greatest moments of his life.
Yeah,
and he was to only survive another 3 years after that.
Mm-hmm. Phil, as I read your account of this, it brought back some memories for me. My dad battled alcoholism. He was a pilot, and he died the week after I graduated from high school. And also the other aspect was that as an eighth grader, I took a tour of the Naval Academy with my class. We went to Washington, D.C., and then over to Annapolis. And I flirted with the idea I had an uncle who was an admiral who had been in the submarine service, and as a kid, I read everything I could about submarines. I was just fascinated with them, including the U-boats and the German use of submarines. And my my uncle, or he was actually a cousin on my father's side, Eddie Welch, was very eager to recruit me. And I remember getting letters from him once a month, and he'd send me, you know, catalogs about the Naval Academy. And unfortunately, you know, I'm about 14 years younger than you. At the very same time, I was becoming more politically aware, and the Vietnam War really, you know, gave me a pretty negative impression of the military and what I might be asked to do if I tried to get appointed to the Naval Academy. So I never pursued it, but, you know, as a teenager, it was something that I thought a lot about. And I just remember seeing the midshipmen at the Naval Academy with those really short haircuts and being forced to take orders all the time. And that whole idea of submitting to authority, I guess, was the deal breaker for me.
Peter B., as always, you had it right. I think probably your travails as a kid did what it did for me. It made you more introspective as a kid. And you know, at the time, since it was 14 years later and all the things were going on here, you saw the handwriting on the wall, and I think all in all, you made some very good decisions back there that I heartily support.
Now, the Naval Academy, there's one story that you told me in the past and that you recount in the book, when a guy named John McCain, who was ahead of you and therefore a superior, I guess you had to submit to his authority, he took you, not quite AWOL, but off premises without permission one night. Tell us that story.
Well, as fate would have it, I and my plebe, or freshman roommates, were in a room right across the hall from John McCain and his roommate. And John was a first classman, and I was a fourth classman. So, of course, you know, everything about being a plebe is yes, sir, no, sir, yes, sir, and I'll find out, sir. And so I had numerous come-arounds to John's room, which, you know, I had to feel out, leave knowledge to him, and so on and so forth. And John was really a wild man as a midshipman. In fact, I'm convinced in my own mind that he never would have graduated from the Naval Academy had he not been the son and grandson of Navy admirals. And, I know that on one occasion, because his conduct was so bad, he got Class A punishments, that he actually had a personal visit to the superintendent of the Naval Academy, Admiral Smedberg, and I never heard of any other midshipman who had a personal visit to the superintendent of the Naval Academy. So he must have gotten, as we say in the Navy, a Dutch uncle talk from Admiral Smedberg. But at any rate, one evening I was braced up against John's wall, bulkhead as we called it, and he told me to get dressed up in night gear and come around to his room at 0200. And he said, do you know what night gear is, Phil? And I said, you know, like a good plebe, I'll find out, sir. And he said, oh, bullshit, I'll tell you what it is, Butler, you stupid idiot. He said, everything you've got that's dark blue cap cover, you know, dark blue service uniform, black shoes, black socks, everything dark. He said, nothing white. He said, wear a blue work shirt. So I went back across the hall to my room and told my roommates this, and we were all, what in the world is this? But I set the alarm for 1:30 and got up and put all this stuff on and went over to his room. I was just about to sound off when I walked into his room, and he grabbed me and put his hand across my mouth and said, shh, follow me. And so out we went, out onto the Naval Academy grounds, out of Bancroft Hall, and all along the wall, that separated the Naval Academy from outside, to a place down close to the main gate in those days where the wall was only about 5 feet high or so. And he said, follow me, and he went over the wall. I went over the wall. Now, this is Class A punishment stuff. It's very, very strong punishment in those days. We walked out onto Maryland Avenue, and there was a taxi cab waiting there, and the cab driver got out. I'll never forget this, and looked at us and said, hello, Johnny, how you been? Haven't seen you in a while. And we got in the cab and drove out to a place 5 or 6 miles away. There was a bar, went in. John ordered 2 beers, and I thought, hot dog, I'm going to get a beer out of this. He looked at me, he said, these are for me, Butler. He said, you don't get any because I don't want to get you in too much trouble. So he drank his beers. We went back and got into the cab and went back to the Naval Academy, and that was my first leadership experience with John McCain. But the bottom line of the thing is, and I was very vocal about not supporting him in his run for president because he is an off-the-wall kind of guy. He has a fiery temper that can come up at any time. Doesn't exhibit, even back in those days, now always doesn't always exhibit what I consider the kind of rational, considered thinking that we need in a president.
Mm-hmm.
So even though he had been a friend of mine back then and was a prisoner of war with me, and note that I said he was with me because he got there 2.5 years after I did.
Indeed.
But even though all those things obtained, I've told everyone that I felt like voting for somebody for president of the United States is far more important than whether that person is a friend or an acquaintance or a coworker or even your blood relative. That it's just too important a job to leave to second class.
Mm-hmm. So, now, one more thing about Annapolis. Recently we went out on the bay to see the Blue Angels fly, and my friend Jory started to tell me that she grew up in Annapolis, and she said, you know, we never went out with those guys from the Naval Academy. She said they were way too dangerous. So what was the social life there? She said that mostly they bust in girls from Pennsylvania.
well, all of us, I guess, lots of guys had their girlfriends from high school or whatever, and I had a girl that was my high school sweetheart that would come out and stay, and we had these little houses all around Annapolis, and people would rent out a room, you know, to your girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Came out. They were called drag houses, and so my girlfriend would come out, the girl I eventually married the day after I graduated, and stay there. I don't know if midshipmen were any more dangerous than the other kids of the age, but
yeah.
So I don't know where exactly that came. It's kind of humorous, but
well, that's a towny girl perception, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so.
So you married Karen, and this will become important later. But you write here in chapter 14, Karen and I seem perfectly aligned in our values socially and politically. She grew up in Chicago, where Southern racism was pretty much unknown to her. She went to integrated schools, but her family moved to Tulsa in her junior and senior high school years, and there she discovered a completely different culture, one that you had described earlier in the book as Southern and very racist. So you really had a strong bond with her, and it seems that in the very early stages of your military career, as you were deployed to the Lemoore base in Southern California, that you had a very tight relationship.
We did. We had a good relationship, and we had a good marriage at the time, but of course something happened in the interim of the 8-year separation. I came home to an immediate divorce. She divorced me immediately upon my return home. At the time, I think we had a good marriage, and we were definitely aligned in values with regard to social issues.
We're talking with Phil Butler about his new book, a memoir, 3 Lives of a Warrior, here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Phil Butler, one of the touching anecdotes in your book is the sequence of events and the timing of the birth of your daughter and your deployment that ultimately led you to fly sorties over North Vietnam.
Yes, I finished flight training in November of 1962 after my graduation. It normally takes about 18 months to get through Navy flight training, and was carrier qualified and all of that, and sent to Naval Air Station Lemoore, California. So we arrived there probably in December or so of 62, and after a brief time with a replacement squadron learning to fly the new airplane, I went to my own squadron, Attack Squadron 22, at NAS Lemoore. Now, squadrons there were based there for their short duty periods, but for a great majority of the time, each of our squadrons were assigned to a ship, and ours was the USS Midway, home ported in Alameda at the time. So I had some cruises that lasted anywhere from what the longest was about 7 months, and others were shorter deployments for aviation practicing all the tactics and things that we did on carriers day and night, until 1965 came around, and we were going to go on a cruise, and this was to be a combat cruise to Vietnam. And my wife, Karen, was pregnant, and she had just had her daughter at the NAS Lemoore Hospital, and I got to see my daughter, Diane, just when she was born, and got to hold her for 2 days until she was 2 days old. And then I had to leave and go to down to Alameda and go aboard USS Midway, leave on that fateful cruise.
Mm-hmm.
And that was March the 4th. My daughter was born on March the 2nd and left her on March the 4th when she was 2 days old.
Wow. And Phil, what did you know about Vietnam at the time that at that very moment, as you're becoming a father, you're deployed to the Midway, you know it's a combat mission, but what did you know about the conflict there, the U.S. entry into it? I'm just curious, what information was available to you at that point?
Everything I think that I and we knew at that time were lies and fabricated information. We had the lies and fabricated information by Lyndon Johnson of the Tonkin Gulf affair and the attack, the so-called attack on the Maddox and all that stuff, which was completely false, not true at all. And then the other lie and fabrication that we had that was created by our government was that domino theory that if we allowed the North Vietnamese communists to take over the South, that there would be a domino effect of communism spreading throughout to Southeast Asia and then into all of Asia and eventually all over the world. So we were going to have to stop communism. There was this huge phobia of the day,
mm-hmm.
Stopping communism. It was, of course, created by the right-wing political machine to support, as we now know, the military-industrial complex that a good Republican president, Dwight Eisenhower, warned us about.
Yeah. And did you, what kind of briefings did you get? Was it mostly all focused on military and these are the targets, here's where the enemy is, and this is what our strategy is? Or were you kind of isolated in an information silo, where you just were told, hey, you're flying tonight, and here's your target, and if you got any questions, keep them to yourself?
That's pretty much it, the latter there. Before each flight, we had a briefing in the ready room, and then we'd go next door down the passageway into the air intelligence spaces, and we'd be briefed by an air intelligence officer with any late-breaking intelligence, if any, on our target areas. And we go out and man our aircraft and get shot off the front of the boat. landing, either daytime, nighttime, or whenever it might be.
Mm-hmm. And just a quick question, which is the bigger rush, the catapult that throws you off and launches your aircraft, or the trickiness of the landing and making sure your tail hook grabs that cable?
Well, both of them definitely get your attention. The catapult is a real charge. I think the catapult's a thrill, although probably it's one of the most dangerous phases, because you have absolutely no control on the catapult. And I did experience one occasion where they miscalibrated the catapult for my airplane. They calibrated it for a lighter aircraft, and I almost went into the water. I came very close to going into the water. It's called a cold catch shot. So you're not in control. But on the other hand, it's really quite a thrill, because in the days of the A4s, when we were fully loaded with up to 22,500 pounds, half of which was external stores, when you were fully loaded like that, they had to get you up to an airspeed of 220 knots, or about 275 miles per hour, in order to get you flyable and get you airborne. So basically, you're sitting there on the catapult, and the thing unleashes, the hydraulic catapult unleashes, and you accelerate from 0 to 275 miles an hour in a space of 188 feet. So that's quite an acceleration, and it's a real thrill. Definitely have to have your head back and the headrest, and you have to be prepared for the shot. But then again, coming around, especially at night and in bad weather, and by the way, the American Navy, the U.S. Navy, is the only Navy in the world that flies at night and in bad weather. We did it in all conditions. And there were some very, very hairy times. I know we POWs used to tell our Air Force cellmates, Navy guys used to tell our Air Force cellmates that combat was nothing compared to coming back and coming aboard, that the hairiest part for a naval officer of a combat air mission was coming back aboard the carrier at night or in bad weather.
Mm-hmm. And, Phil, how many flights did you make successfully before the night that your plane went down?
Well, combat missions, I had 13.
13.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I'm short one landing. I have one more takeoff than landing in my logbook.
Yeah, indeed. Now, you were flying an A4, and you relate in the book that you were a bit of a guinea pig, that you were the first test pilot for the Mark 81 VT electrically fused bombing system, and it failed.
Yes, it did. They had a huge store back in the United States of World War II iron 250, 500-pound, and 1,000-pound bombs. And so they shipped all these things out to the ships to be used in Vietnam. You know, here we were in 1965. We're like 20 years later. And we're still using these same old iron bombs, which work fine if they just drop, and they normally have a little wire that goes through the arming mechanism, and when they drop away from your airplane, the wire pulls out and the bomb becomes armed. But in this case, they thought of some new tricky thing. They equipped our aircraft with these electrical fusing devices, and the idea was that they armed the bombs with impact crystals in the nose, so that when the bomb was 6 feet above the ground, it would be armed, and it would sense a pressure wave coming back towards it from the ground and explode at that point, which made it much more devastating for light trucks and personnel, which was the problem. They didn't have armored equipment that we were after. We were after their trucks and people that were moving up and down Highway 1, taking men and equipment down into South Vietnam. So we were doing these missions at night when they were running the trucks down the highway. And the idea when you let your bombs go off was that they left your airplane and they armed themselves on the way down. And then when they were 6 feet below your airplane, when they were 6 feet above the ground, they would all detonate. So that night, I was in a 45-degree dive, I reached the bomb release altitude of 2,500 feet, and I was doing 500 knots, in other words, over 600 miles an hour in a 45-degree dive. I pressed the bomb release button, and the bombs, eight of them all went off together in ripple fire, as I had set them to do, to get the trucks that I had in my gun sight below me. But instead of arming above the ground and going off, they armed 6 feet below my airplane, and all of them went off underneath my airplane. So when that happened, it blew the wings and the aft empennage off my airplane, and I became a very, very fast-moving, downward-angled cockpit heading rapidly for the ground.
So, just to recap, the Pentagon's inventory clearance sent these World War II munitions that were then jerry-rigged with this new detonation system that failed, and that's what actually caused your plane to go down. You said you were in a sky full of lead, but you were not hit by the enemy anti-aircraft fire.
This is true, yeah. No, I was. This was a case, another case of what you might call friendly fire. Or your own equipment, you know, does you in. And right, they were so anxious to drop bombs and come up with new stuff that they were just experimenting with this stuff. And I was the first pilot to go down from this stuff, and I understand, I heard that several other pilots got killed doing the same thing after me. They didn't figure it out. And then also Jeremiah Denton in an A-6 and his Bombardier Navigator and an A-6 went down with the same thing, and after that, I guess they figured it out and stopped using that system. So at least three of us became prisoners of war from it, and several other guys probably were killed because of the same stupid system.
So talk next about the sequence of events as you recognized that your plane was going to crash. And you had a few choices to make about ejection or, making sure that your parachute would deploy. Take us through that that part of the episode.
Well, I recall that there was this huge explosion and everything went black, and I found myself whirling through the air in a cockpit. I was sort of tumbling forward in this cockpit, which was not a good aircraft system to be flying in. Nothing, everything turned to lead in the cockpit. It was black, and my control stick was useless. And everything happened so very fast that I realized that I was being thrown around into the cockpit in such a way as I was pulling a lot of negative G-forces, and I was thrown up against the canopy of the cockpit. My head was up against the canopy. And I would think I was experiencing probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 4 negative G-forces. And so I tried to reach behind me to get to the face curtain to pull down to make the ejection system work, but I couldn't get to it because my head was thrown up against the canopy. So I was able instinctively to reach down between my legs and grab an auxiliary key handle on the seat pan and give that a yank, and that loaded and threw me, ejected me up the ejection rails and out into the cold black night air. But the ride itself was something because my rear end was about 3 or 4 inches above, separated from the seat. So the seat slammed into me and actually compression fractured 7 vertebrae in my back. Mm. Although I'm not complaining because I'm here and alive today.
And Phil, this all happened very quickly. If you were at 2,500 feet when you deployed your bombs, then it wasn't that far to the ground, and at 600 miles an hour, your original speed, this all must have happened extremely quickly.
This is all split seconds, and it's all happening not because of my thinking about it, but because of training.
Mm-hmm.
It's just all of that repetition and training that pays off. You don't even think about this kind of stuff. You just react instantaneously as a pilot to these things because you've had this training in ejection seat trainers and, you know, so many. many times, and you just do it without even thinking about it. So I went out the airplane, and I like to tell people that to give you an idea of what it might be like, if you could propel your car down one of our expressways up to 600 miles an hour, and let's say you have a convertible, and then and when you reach 600 miles an hour out there on this expressway, you stand up. That's exactly what it felt like when I went out of the cockpit.
Yeah.
And the chute opened, the seat mechanism kicked me away from the seat, and the parachute opened, and it partially shredded some of the panels in the parachute, so that I was partly being stopped, you know, in this descent, and then partly the chute was streaming.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have been killed at that point. Another near-death experience happened, and I went through a canopy of 150 or 200 feet high, the canopy of trees that caught my chute and parachute risers and helped break my fall. I went through the trees and down in and bounced off the ground, my legs and butt, and then found myself dangling out of the tree about 6 feet above the ground. And there I was, hanging in a tree in the middle of the night, just north of Ben, North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. So you cut yourself loose and tried to get your bearings, and you say here that I remembered a briefing we had received a couple of days before, where some Air Force guys came out to the ship and briefed us on rescue and pickup in North Vietnam. They said it was impossible to pick someone up in the Vin area at this time. That must have been real reassuring at that moment when you realized that you were on the ground in an area where they wouldn't be able to rescue you.
Yes, Jack, we were briefed that if we went down over that target, that you know, our air intelligence briefing was if we went down over that target, that we were to try to make our way west to the Laotian border, where we could be rescued from Air Force helicopter sites, but that where we were there near Vin, we couldn't be rescued. It turned out later that one of my Naval Academy classmates and very good friends was a helicopter pilot on the Midway, and he went up and begged the admiral to let them come closer, you know, to the shore, so that he could fly in and try and find me. But his request was turned down; they didn't let him do it. So that night, I started making my way westward towards the Laotian border, because I knew that I had to get out of that area first of all, because that's where I'd gone down; that's where they'd be looking for me. And so I had to evade capture as long as I could, and try to make it to the Laotian border.
Mm-hmm. And so you were at large for a couple of days.
4 days and nights.
Mm-hmm.
4 days and nights of evading. It's quite an evasion experience. Numerous experiences during that 4 days and nights. And at the end of the 4 days and nights, I was finally tracked down and actually captured by two well-trained German police dogs that were tracking dogs, and you know, police dogs, and they had tracked me from where I had originally gone down, and the guy who handled the dogs had my helmet that I had thrown off and thrown down on the ground. Of course, I didn't need that; that would have been just in the way. But they used that for the scent to track me.
Yeah. And so, as you were first taken into custody, what was your frame of mind? You hadn't been sleeping much, obviously. You were on the run, and you had an injury to your hand. How would you describe your wits and your ability? pardon me. Your ability to handle this situation that no one could possibly have been trained for.
Well. I don't know. I was an American naval officer and a combat pilot out there, and so I just figured immediately upon being captured that I had to conduct myself officer and military man, and we had, you know, had many briefings and training before in survival school about being a prisoner and how we had to stay with name, rank, service number, date of birth, and try and maintain your military bearing. And that's what I tried to do, and I think by and large the Vietnamese that had me those first few days pretty much respected that and saw me as a combatant officer.
And so, briefly give us a sketch of from the time you were taken captive to when you first arrived in Hanoi.
Well, the first thing that happened was I was paraded through a number of Vietnamese little small communities to be shown off. And they'd have bright lights out, and they'd parade me out and stand me up on a stand and have a bunch of people around, and the political cadres would be talking Vietnamese to the people, and the people would be shouting and shaking their fists at me and all that kind of stuff. And every once in a while, going through crowds, people would be allowed to take a swat at me. This went on for a couple of days before they finally got me in a jeep and took me to a prison in Vinh, in the city of Vinh. I was in that prison for 2 days, and the camp commander there was not a guy who spoke any English, and he didn't have anybody with him that spoke any English. He had one young guy who looked like a civilian, even didn't have a uniform on, that spoke Russian. And this guy asked me if I spoke Russian, and I said no. So that kind of ended the interrogation part of things. But I was only there in that prison for 2 days before they sent a jeep down from Hanoi pick me up in the middle of the night, one night, and drove me up to Hanoi to the prison called Hoa Lo, which is the Hanoi Hilton.
Yeah. And let's pause here for a moment, Phil, to talk about some of the names that were used, the epithets, if you will. Viet Cong, North Vietnamese were referred to as Charlie in a general sense, and derisively as Gooks. And I'm pleased that you didn't sanitize the book of those expressions. And you also named your captors Crazy Charlie, Stone Face, a lot of different names because they didn't give you their formal names in most cases. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I went through, I guess, a little bit of self-search and introspection before I wrote this book. And writing an autobiography is really a different cat. It's, you know that you're going to have to reveal yourself. And so I had to go through this introspective thing, how am I going to write this book? How am I going to say some of this stuff that maybe just degrading things about me, or it might even say things about other people I know or have known, or even people I love. And ultimately, I just decided that if I was going to write the book, it would have to be honest. So that's what I tried to do. The entire book, from beginning to end, I wrote everything as honestly as I knew it and had experienced it to be. So I think that everything in the book is honest, including all the language we used as combatants and prisoners of war and all of that stuff. So that when the whole POW experience is as I recounted it immediately upon my return to San Diego and my debriefing with a Navy Air Intelligence officer and the angry, very angry, pissed off Lieutenant Commander Phil Butler relating his experiences that I had committed to memory from beginning to end. 36 hours of debriefing. And so the whole second life is taken from that debriefing, and I have not changed any of the language at all that we use. The only thing I did was I took out all of my debriefer's questions and his conversation. And then, of course, there are places in interviews, probably even in this interview, where politicians and you know, say the same thing twice or three times. So when that happened, I did take out that stuff, but everything in the second life of the book, the whole debriefing part, is honest, just as I said it in February of 1973 when I came home.
So, Phil, you spent 2,855 days in custody of the North Vietnamese. The early years were very bleak. You suffered from illnesses, from some wounds that you got as your plane came down. You were often in solitary confinement. So I'd like to ask you to comment about a few of these things and give people a quick sketch of the rigors that you endured, first of all, just in routine life, and then I'd like to talk about the interrogations and some of the other very difficult situations that you faced.
Well, one of the ways I think that I look at my 8-year experience is in phases of treatment. And basically, there were three distinct phases of treatment that I experienced while I was there. First phase, the initial phase, I call it, lasted for only 6 months. And that was from April of 1965 to September of 1965. And during this period of time, when I was in the Hanoi Hilton, all of our guards around us were Hanoi cops. They were policemen. And we had the camp commander, who was a military guy. We had a couple of interrogators that were probably civilians or might have been in the military, though they never wore any uniforms. And the treatment during this phase was not nearly as intense as it got to be later. During this initial treatment, for example, in the beginning, I was subjected to 7 firing squads, mock firing squads. And that got to be, after 3 or 4 of them, that got to be a little comical. In the beginning, I had round-the-clock interrogations. They were subjecting me to sleep deprivation. There were slaps and sort of light beatings were happened occasionally, but not all the time. There was withholding of food and water. Of course, I and all of us were isolated from the outside world, and we were in solitary confinement for the most part. And then the final part of the thing was exploitation, which is against Geneva Conventions. They tried to take POWs out to show them off to foreign journalists so that they could exploit us and say, you know, things like we were sorry for our crimes that we had committed against the Vietnamese people and so on and so forth. And they could just show us off and sort of ramp up the pressure on the United States by doing that out in public, which is completely against Geneva Conventions. However, the Vietnamese were not signatories to any Geneva Conventions and were not members of any international organizations against torture. So in September of 1965, the second phase started, and that's when all of us were turned over to the North Vietnamese Army. At that point, we began to experience vicious beatings, in which cases there were some deaths. And this period, by the way, lasted for 4 years. So from September of 1965 to September the 9th of 1969, and I'll tell you why it was that date, the treatment under the Army was vicious beatings, lashing with radiator belts that were cut at one point and used as a lash on bare legs, buttocks, and backs, constant use of stocks, leg irons, and restraints, handcuffs behind the back and legs and stocks, tortures through the use of handcuffs, cut off circulation, twist your arms behind your back, and ratchet handcuffs down with little lever bars to cut through the skin and cut off circulation. And this torture becomes so painful with within about a half an hour that you feel like somebody has a blowtorch on your hands. Rope tortures put you into extreme positions and twist you around. It's very much like the medieval torture of the rack, only without the rack, but the same ropes and the same idea. They use electrical shocks. They use sleep and sensory deprivation, exposure to heat, cold, and especially to mosquitoes, which was very terrible.
And some rats, too. You lived with large rats.
I lived with very large rats that they had running around all over the place, too. Torture positions, the so-called stress positions that you've probably heard about used in Guantanamo and places.
Mm-hmm.
Withholding of food and water, isolations, and so forth. And they were after confessions in 1966. They tortured everybody in a camp that I was in called the Briar Patch for confessions. They were successful in getting a confession out of everybody. I wrote about a six-line confession that the document that I'm most proud of anything I've written in my whole life.
Hmm.
It was full of grammatical errors and stuff. I finally managed to get that through. And then in September of 1969, all of a sudden one day, the camp went quiet. Guards didn't come around. There was obvious funeral music being played outside over loudspeakers. And finally, when the guards and camp officers came around, opened our cell doors, they all had black armbands, and they told us that President Ho Chi Minh had died.
Yeah.
And after that day, commencing almost immediately the next day, that all of that treatment changed dramatically.
And why do you think that was? What?
That's because it was his policy to do that to us, and they were in a complete and total dictatorship, and mm-hmm. that was Ho Chi Minh's policy. And when the next guy took over in his place, Vietnamese named Le Duan, L-E-D-U-A-N, he was a pragmatist, and he changed the treatment immediately. He'd probably been secretly agitating for it before that, to keep us all alive, because he knew that we would be worth our weight in real estate if they could keep us alive.
Mm-hmm.
So the final period, 3.5 years, September of 69 until February of 73, was warehousing. We were still kept separated from the outside world. After a while, some guys were allowed to receive remnants of packages from home.
Yeah.
I'd say remnants because there wasn't much in them after the Vietnamese had robbed them.
Yeah.
Isolation from home, news, and each other, even though we were in cells with up to 40 guys later on in the time, we were still kept separated from each other. But all the heavy-handed stuff and the torture and abuse and harassment from that point on pretty much was eliminated. And we were given much more greater rations of food. They had rudimentary medical care for us at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And we each got extra blankets and clothing to keep us warm. And so, we were in a much better position to survive at that point. Probably if that second treatment period of 4 years had continued through another 3.5 years, I probably wouldn't be alive today.
Yeah. And, Phil, there's a lot of rich detail, and I encourage people to get your book and read it. And they can find it at the website 3livesofawarrior.com. Spell out the word 3, 3livesofawarrior.com. I want to ask you about a few things, though, because I was intrigued in those early years up until Ho Chi Minh died. You were segregated pretty carefully, and you might be in a double cell, but you had very little communication with your fellow POWs, and yet you devised a very intricate system of tap codes, not Morse code, but your own codes, and you sometimes shifted the codes if you thought that the gooks, as you called them, might have cracked your code. And I wonder if you'd take your finger to the telephone right now and just tap out Phil so that people could get a sense of how intricate the system was, but how effective it was for you to communicate with your fellow American prisoners.
Okay, here's my name. That's it. Anybody in the camp would have known that that was Phil Butler. And sometimes, for example, this letter might follow that. And what I just, the first two letters I sent were PB, which mm-hmm. everybody in the camp knew was Phil Butler, and Q was our euphemistic term for an interrogation. It meant quiz. We uh-huh. called them quizzes.
Right.
So PBQ meant Phil Butler just went to an interrogation.
Uh-huh.
And so that's how things got shortened, and that's how they got sent in this rapid fire. The TAP code itself, I think, has a fascinating and long history, which is explained in the book. And by the way, in the book, I also have diagrams of the TAP code and another code that we use called a mute code to get visual contact with somebody, and you could send letters of the alphabet very rapidly when you were experienced at doing it,
mm-hmm.
to pass messages and information. The idea behind the whole thing being that we had to communicate with each other and maintain our cohesion, because the Vietnamese objective was to keep us separated and exploit us for political propaganda. Therefore, the way we fought this was to stick together and to confront and fight this system as a group.
Mm-hmm.
The TAP code hails actually from prisons probably hundreds of years back. Guys in solitary confinement have been tapping codes to each other. Arthur Kessler's Darkness at Noon book, Darkness at Noon,
mm-hmm.
talks about a Russian tap code. So we had one POW early on, a guy named Smitty Harris, who had learned just after the Korean War in a training session about a tap code that Korean POWs had used, because there were some Korean POWs who had been convicts in our country, and they were given the option of either stay in jail or go fight in Korea. They became POWs, and they spread this code around. And so he knew what it was. He told four others of us what this code was, and from there we passed it on to everybody that came in, got this new code matrix,
mm-hmm.
and we used it very successfully to communicate in camps, within camps, and even between camps at times, and that we were able to maintain our military cohesion and our cohesion as a fighting group.
Phil, one of the other things you mentioned is that to warn other prisoners that a guard was coming, you would cough to interrupt the tap code or any other kind of surreptitious conversations or communications that were underway. Didn't the guards ever get wind of that, that the cough meant that they were there?
They did, but it was tough. They did, but it was tough for them to do anything about it because they wouldn't know where the cough came from. They didn't know who coughed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we're always one step ahead. They would find out things, and we would be creative and figure out a new way to get around it, just like I think convicts do in prisons today. They find ways of getting around and communicating and making weapons and doing all the things that they do, and even getting drugs, I guess, in our prison today, because one of the things we had that the guards didn't and officers didn't have, we had a lot of time on our hands, and we were smart, intelligent, almost all of us college graduates, officers who were pilots, so we got very creative in ways of communicating and maintaining our integrity. And I think I spent a lot of time on this in the book. I spent several hundred pages talking about how we did it and
mm-hmm.
how we managed to survive as a group, because being a prisoner of war is not an individual sport. It's a team effort.
Yeah.
Basically, that's how we were able to survive, by supporting each other.
Phil, I want to read a passage here that you wrote about solitary confinement. And it reminded me, I have a friend who was, he spent 23 years at San Quentin on a 7-year sentence. And he got caught up in the parole system. They wouldn't let him out for a long time. And after he'd been in about 15 years, I was visiting him one day, and he said, "You know, Peter, He said, this indefinite thing is just what blows my mind. He said, it's so hard to deal with that I don't know when this is going to end. He said, give me a sentence. He said, 10 years, 15 years, give me a firm sentence, and I'll start whacking away at it. That was his term for it. And his spirit was not killed by it, but it certainly was dampened by the open-ended nature of his confinement. And you wrote, so solitary confinement is tough, but it isn't a big bad ogre, and it won't make a nut out of you. It's just a matter of learning to deal with it. Just like escape and evasion training, being alone should be taught as part of what happens if you become a prisoner of war. Guys need to learn what it's like to live with themselves, how to be independent, completely independent, and what it's like to make all your decisions on your own. It's especially important to have some training on how to come to rational conclusions while being in a solitary situation, since it is so different from the world that we live in today. And that attitude is something that I have to describe as indomitable. And it really defines you, I think, as a person, Phil.
Well, I think growing up as a kid, I've had family members tell me that I was a very introverted kid growing up. And even as a kid, I think I enjoyed doing things by myself, being alone, going fishing, you know, going hunting, going out with my dog, or just hanging around, you know, whatever kids do. And I think that one of the biggest problems for some people always have to have somebody around them. They always have to be with somebody. They always have to be talking to somebody. And that's a serious detriment when you get into a tough situation where you find yourself alone. I think maybe even at the end of life, it could be tough for somebody to realize, you know, come to the terms of the fact that they're going to go out of this world the way they came in, by themselves. But I think, especially for Americans tend to be so gregarious that they have a really hard time being with themselves. And when they are put by themselves, they find out that self is maybe their worst enemy, or maybe it's somebody they don't really like very much.
Phil, one of your coping mechanisms was to build a jukebox in your head. And I have a lot of songs that are in my head, and when I can't sleep at night, I really like Brooke Benton's Rainy Night in Georgia. there are a lot of other songs that, you know, I will call up, and they're not listed as like J15, and I don't have to put a quarter in. But in this era of iPods and music on demand, tell us a little bit about how you developed your own personal jukebox that was completely inside you.
One thing, Peter B., is, you know, you and I are separated by a generation for sure, musically as well. Just mentioning that song separates us right away, because all the songs that I do were from the 40s and 50s.
Uh-huh.
And especially, for some reason, I especially remember and know the words to songs even from the 1930s and 1940s, because my dad used to sing them, and I used to hear them on the radio when I was a little kid. And I guess I was impressionable, and somehow or another the words would sink in. I knew the words to things I didn't even really knew. I thought I knew that I knew the words to. But early on in solitary confinement, I started listening to music in my head, and I discovered if I knew a song, I could have just about any artist that I want sing it for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it became a great diversion. And then later on in prison, as I began to build these songs up in my mind, I started arranging them in alphabetical order, believe it or not. And then later on, when I had cellmates and could communicate with guys, I was always asking any guy that I met, do you know the words to, you know, such and such a song? Or, you know, maybe I'd know, for example, the first verse of a song and the bridge and the last verse.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always that second verse that's only sung once, because, you know, in popular songs, they sing it through verse 1, 2, then the bridge, then the final verse, and then there's a little interlude with the orchestra, and then they come back and sing the bridge and the final verse again.
It's right.
Always done. That's the Frank Sinatra, you know, any of those artists in the 30s and 40s, that's the way they would sing it. So yeah, I was always querying guys for words to songs, and then of course when I came home, I found out I had a few of the lyrics a little messed up, but they were pretty good all in all. You know, I had a couple hundred.
Mm-hmm. That's really neat. Well, Phil, let's fast forward because after Ho Chi Minh died, the treatment got better. You spent a little time at a remote camp, I believe, in the north part of North Vietnam, appeared to be in the mountains. And then lead us up to the news that you ultimately got that it was time to go home.
Well, we were in this camp. Because they were bombing Hanoi, they moved us up to this camp way up on the northern border with China near a town up there called Lang Son. And this camp, we called it Dog Patch. And we were up there for, I guess, close to a year. And all of a sudden, they got happy in the camp, and they came around with big trucks, and they loaded us with all of our stuff into trucks and drove us down the horrible bumpy road back down to Hanoi and brought us back down to the Hanoi Hilton to the very large open camp that we had spent some time in years before. And we were able to go outside and communicate with practically anybody we want to there for a couple weeks. And, of course, we all knew that release was imminent. Finally, one day, they brought us all out. And our senior officers put us in formation, which was really cool. Our senior officer reported to the camp commander, saluted him, even got a salute back, as opposed to being called a criminal. And you're not in the military, you're not an officer, you're a criminal. All those years, and he read out this thing to us in English. Said that we were to be released and what the terms were and so forth. And so the next couple of days, we were all given these ugly gray suit, sort of leisure suit-looking things to wear out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And airplane load by airplane load, we went out. It took several weeks to get everybody out.
And we should note that you were on the very first flight in recognition that you were the seventh longest-held American POW in North Vietnam.
Yeah, that's right. Lucky number seven. In accordance with the Geneva Conventions, which is how they did the release, the Vietnamese agreed to doing it in accordance with the Geneva Conventions. Geneva Conventions state that the first POWs to be repatriated will be the ones that were held the longest, but the very first ones repatriated would be the sick and wounded,
mm-hmm.
and any civilians that might be held. So we had our sick and wounded. We had a few of those guys who were guys that had just been shot down. Maybe they were B-52 crew members or something, so we had a few of those guys. And I think we had maybe a couple of civilian CIA-type guys, and then the rest of us in order of how long we had been there. So when we flew out of there and we flew to Clark Air Base from Hanoi, and we got off the airplane in order of shoot downs because the sick and wounded were taken out in stretchers out the back of the C-141.
Mm-hmm.
So I was the seventh guy to walk out of the airplane into the bright lights of my new world.
How did that feel?
I think it was surreal. It was, in some sense, exciting, exhilarating, but it was surreal and almost too much to believe. We had no idea that the reception that we were going to get from people, that we had no idea that we were going to be the returning heroes that people in this country had made us out to be at that point.
Mm-hmm. Well, Phil, I want to break here. Pardon me. Phil, I want to break here, and we will continue our conversation in the next podcast, where we'll talk about your return home, the nation that you found, and how you transitioned to becoming a warrior for peace. Phil Butler is our guest in this special two-part podcast. And again, his website, threelivesofawarrior.com. I'll include that in the show file at peterbcollins.com. But I want you to have it, spell out the number, threelivesofawarrior.com. We're talking with Dr. Philip Butler, and his new book is, of course, Three Lives of a Warrior. And now, Gary Chu, the official film reviewer of the Peter B. Collins Show, checks in and tells us about the new film about the young John Lennon, Nowhere Boy.
Having been sufficiently culture-shocked by a Tupelo, Mississippi rhythm and blues shooting star, the anonymous British teenager informs his mom he wants to be another Elvis Presley. Effusively, his mom demurs, "God saving you to be John Lennon." Aaron Johnson portrays John Lennon as all at sea and nowhere boy, but as the lyric to the Lennon-McCartney song has it, John is anything but a nowhere man. This troubled and latently talented boy poet, as all well know, later acquits himself of ever making nowhere plans for nobody, no way, especially himself. By the way, Nowhere Man comes from October 65's Rubber Soul. Since I can't conceive of not having had Lennon and the rest of the Beatles coming into my 20-something life when I was a rock and roll radio DJ, I'm ill-equipped to say how a lesser-known portion of Lennon's younger days, however accurately or inaccurately they're depicted in this film, will affect younger people in 2010. Keep that in mind as you listen on. After absorbing the story told in Nowhere Boy, it seems to me now that Lennon's highly developed feminine side was due to his Aunt Mimi, played by Kristin Scott Thomas, and his mother, Julia, played by Anne Marie Duff. Both women, who couldn't have been more different, loved John very much. Each, in her way, spoiled Lennon rotten, but not without a familial dissonance playing heavily on his personality. That Sam Taylor Wood, who directed Nowhere Boy, is female, could have something to do with the excellent and important roles played by Ms. Scott Thomas and Ms. Duff. Both are memorable. Oedipal vibes fairly spark between Lennon and his mom, she being a sensuous, outgoing woman to all around her, to the point that John is jealous, although their association remains a proper one. Aunt Mimi is the prim and proper older sister, who, in her smug authoritarian way, kicks butt when John is being parented by her at home with husband George. John has a warm and nurturing relationship with Uncle George, played by David Threlfall. The reasons John is brought up by Aunt Mimi are a large part of the film, and I don't want to dwell on them here. That's for you to absorb and learn more about watching the picture. However, the story begins about when hormones are really kicking in on the teenage Lennon. Problems at school are a big item, his grades sucking, Aunt Mimi demolished by the news as it makes its way home. Another tough row to hoe is Uncle George's sudden death. As John's mom lives quite close in the neighborhood with her husband, not Lennon's father, by the way, and their two girls, the Beatle-to-be uses a back-and-forth method, typical in broken homes, of manipulating Julia and Aunt Mimi to get his way, and ultimately, too, his first guitar. John, as many his age then, is smitten with America's Presley and, of course, Buddy Holly. Lennon receives the rudiments of playing fretted stringed instruments from his mother, on a banjo. It's a great scene with snappy time-lapse photography to keep the narrative apace. Yet another rich scene shows Lennon in the boys' loo at school, knighting, I guess you could call it, members of his first band, the Skiffle Group. The band makes waves and draws the attention of a lad who plays guitar backwards. That would be another Liverpool bloke named McCartney, played by Thomas Sangster. All kinds of interesting dynamics go on between this real pair to draw to that, on your part, ought to be apprehended cold watching the film. I was shaving at my bathroom mirror soon to go to work at a South Texas public television station when the radio told me that John Lennon had been shot to death in New York City. It came close to being much like another day, I recall, this one in late November of 63, when I was in a radio studio dubbing PSA announcements of the Postmaster General of the United States advising all of us to mail early for Christmas. I remember neither of those days as being merry. And such a feeling is perpetuated in Nowhere Boy, at least for a former rock jock with gray hair. The film begins with the famously familiar, loud and mighty open guitar chord that indicates you're gonna hear Hard Day's Night, although the song itself doesn't materialize. But we know what it is, and that's enough. Because it makes us feel all right. Ow! The guy with this voice has film reviews he hopes that will make you feel all right online at TulsaTVMemories.com and under reviews at IMDb.com. I'm Gary Chu, over and down in the valley, just northeast of Eden.
Part two of our conversation with former POW Phil Butler in the next podcast. Email Peter at PeterBCollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.